I heard a cry.
That was me.
I heard a cry.
That was me.
I heard a cry.
That was me.
I heard a cry.
Direction point! Direction point!
A Doctor Who Podcast Network.
Well, hi, everybody. Welcome back to Doctor Who Literature, the podcast taking you through the world of the Doctor Who novelizations put out by Target Books from 1973 onward. We're a member of the Direction Point Doctor Who Podcast Network. My name is Jason, and I'm your host on this journey, this very long journey. We are currently taking a one-week break between the 1981 and 1982 novelizations. If you are a new listener, welcome to the show. Ordinarily, we read through one book a week in publication order and have a conversation with one guest, partially about the book, but mostly about the larger world of Doctor Who or our own personal interests. These are pretty freewheeling and wide-ranging conversations, and there's almost always some sort of trivia game at the end. This week is a season break. I take a one-week break in between every 2 years worth of Target Books. This is the end of season 4, which was the 1980 and 1981 novelizations. Then we'll be beginning season 5, starting with the January 1982 novelization of State of Decay next week. That is the first novelization of a Doctor Who story from the John Nathan Turner era. Then JNT ended up being the producer of Doctor Who for the rest of the show's classic run and for most of the rest of the novelization's tenure. We'll be dealing with JNT and his legacy quite a bit, starting next week for the first time on the show. This week, however, is a different episode, a change of pace, as I do in between every 2 years' worth of books. I want to talk about two topics this week, and I have two incredible guests who are joining me. First, I want to read to you a passage that to American readers of Doctor Who novelizations will be very familiar. They could not have been more offended, confused, enraged, and startled. There was a moment of stunned silence, and then an eruption of angry voices from all over the 1,500-person auditorium. The kids in their Luke Skywalker pajamas, cobbled up from older brothers' cast-off karate gi, and the adults spot-welded into their Darth Vader fright masks howled with fury. But I stood my ground, there on the lecture platform at the World Science Fiction Convention, and I repeated the heretical words that had sent them into animal hysterics. Star Wars is adolescent nonsense. Close Encounters is obscurantist drivel. Star Trek can turn your brains into puree of bat guano. And the greatest science fiction series of all time is Doctor Who. And I'll take you all on one by one or all in a bunch to back it up. Auditorium monitors moved in. Truncheons ready to club down anyone foolish enough to try jumping the lecture platform. And finally, there was relative silence. And I heard scattered voices screaming from the back of the room, "Who?" And I said, "Yes, who?" That is the first three paragraphs of the introduction written by Harlan Ellison for the Pinnacle Books, American reprints of 10 select Target novelizations spanning the John Pertwee and Tom Baker eras, or if you will, the Barry Letts and Philip Hinchcliffe eras, going from book number 1, Day of the Daleks, up through, in chronological order, The Talons of Wang Chiang. Harlan Ellison, a 7-page introduction. I do not believe that this was ever reprinted in the Target books in the UK. I do not believe there is any Target equivalent to this. But for the American audience, Harlan Ellison did write this very two-fisted, excellent introduction. I am not going to read the whole thing, but you can almost certainly find it. It is very well informed about Doctor Who, talks a lot about the Philip Hinchcliffe era and the various villains that the Doctor meets therein, talks about how Philip Hinchcliffe got introduced to the show, For years, this introduction was a little puzzling to me. Harlan Ellison was incredibly prolific, but I believe this was the only thing that he committed to paper about Doctor Who. And for us American fans, we were always left wondering, how did this come to be? How did Harlan Ellison come to write the introduction for Pinnacle Books? Was he a fan of the show? Was he really a fan of the show? Where did this come from? And how does he say positive things about the Android Invasion? As you probably heard in my previous episode about the Android Invasion novelization, episode 44, this is how I discovered Harlan Ellison. Buying this novelization, or rather having my grandmother buy it for me when I was 11 years old, at a used bookshop on King's Highway in Brooklyn. I had been a Doctor Who fan for about 6 months. I'd been reading the novelizations for about 3 or 4 months. This was the first time that I heard of Harlan Ellison. And you'll hear a little more about my Harlan Ellison journey later in the program. But I have been introduced to a listener named Jason Davis, who was Harlan Ellison's editor for the last several years of Ellison's life. He is a wealth of knowledge about Harlan and about other science fiction shows. He is Jason Davis, and he is the first of my 2 interviews in this program. You can find Jason at his website, Humanity Is My Business, and this is at thejasondavis.com. It is an excellent website, and I spent a lot of time going through it before I met Jason for the first time in person at Gallifrey One after a long email correspondence. Then I conducted an interview with Jason about Harlan Ellison and also about an upcoming novelization for this program. You will hear the Harlan Ellison portion of the interview, and the rest of it will be reserved for when the first novelization that Jason selected to talk about for the show comes up in publication order in the not-too-distant future. A little bit later on in the program is my latest interview with Philip Hinchcliffe. We lost Chris Boucher, who passed away in December 2022. He was the last surviving television writer from Doctor Who's first 2 decades, the 1960s and 70s. He wrote 3 very highly regarded stories for seasons 14 and 15, The Face of Evil, The Robots of Death, and Image of the Fendal. Robots of Death in particular came in number 11 all time in the latest Doctor Who magazine survey of all Doctor Who stories published in 2014. That's 11 out of the first 50 years of the program. That will do well for you. DWM is in the process of coming up with a new survey covering Doctor Who's first 60 years, and I don't imagine that Robots of Death is going to drop too far in the rankings versus the last 10 years of stories that have come out since the 2014 survey. It is widely considered one of Doctor Who's all-time greats, and we have been hearing brief audio excerpts of it throughout this episode. Philip was very kind enough. I emailed him the day that Chris Boucher passed away, and as always, Philip has been very generous with this program, and with me, and with you, my audience, with his time, and talking to me about his memories of Chris Boucher. They're very good memories, and I look forward to sharing them with you. This episode would not exist without the help of listener David Barsky. He is the one who set up the introductions between Philip and myself and Jason Davis and myself. This program would be a much poorer place without him. And this episode is once again given producer credit to David Barsky. I know he hates when I do that, but he totally deserves the producer credit this time around. This episode literally would not exist without David Barsky out there for me, finding me these great guests. Later on, at the very end of the program, will be excerpts of an interview that I did with David Barsky and Bill Evenson, another frequent guest on this program, at Gallifrey One in Los Angeles 2 weeks ago. So we have a lot of good material to talk about this week. Harlan Ellison, Chris Boucher, amazing interviews with Jason Davis and Philip Hinchcliffe. Let's get to it.
A Whovian and a Nuvian walk into a TARDIS
and explore every episode of the classic Doctor Who series.
Join me, podcaster John S. Drew,
and me, writer-editor Jim Beard, as we take apart each story starting from the very beginning in 1963.
And join us on our Facebook page and Twitter, where we continue the discussion with you with historical artifacts from British papers of the time. The Doctor's Beard Podcast, released every Saturday around tea time on your favorite podcasting app.
And we'll see you in time and space. You're listening to Doctor Who Literature. Keep turning the pages.
So I'm standing here in Los Angeles at Gallifrey 1 with Jason Davis. Jason, I was looking at your website, and I was trying to come up with a 45-second biography of you, and 45 minutes probably would not do it justice. But you have done extensive writing on the universes of Babylon 5 and the X-Files. Yeah. And you are the director of the Harlan Ellison Books Preservation Project.
All correct, yeah. And I think that's a pretty good summation of everything I've done that would be of interest to anybody other than me.
How did you come to meet Harlan Ellison?
I came to Harlan Ellison through Doctor Who. I think I'd seen his Geo Metro commercials in the late 80s, but I got into Doctor Who starting in 1989. And accidentally was given a Pinnacle edition when I had been religiously collecting the Targets. I didn't know the Pinnacles even existed. I didn't know there had been an American edition of the various titles. And somebody gave me Seeds of Doom by Philip Hinchcliffe, and it had the introduction by the guy who was selling Geo Metros at the top of it. And something about just the aggressiveness of the come on to Doctor Who appealed to me. I can't tell you why. You know, I come from a very quiet family, people who speak on a very low timbre, so it's not, you know, it's unusual to me to be attracted to something loud and abrasive, and that's what did it. And a few years later, he started doing commentaries on the Sci-Fi Channel, on Sci-Fi Buzz, and I don't recall, I don't think I ever mentioned Doctor Who in them, but I just found his personality appealing and started reading everything that he wrote. So yeah, Doctor Who was my entry drug.
It's funny because, number one, you are sharing this episode with Philip Hinchcliffe, so it all comes back to Philip in a way. This episode is not sponsored by Geo or Geo Metro, but I'll reach out to them. I also came to Harlem the exact same way. I'm 11 years old. It's early 1985. My grandmother takes me to a used bookshop on King's Highway in Brooklyn. That I was already a Doctor Who fan, looking for any Doctor Who novelization I could find. The proprietor of the store, which I'm sure is long since defunct and is now a bank branch, goes to the back of a shelf, just for a sec, and pulls out a very used copy of Doctor Who and the Android Invasion, which I have brought along with me. And it's the only Doctor Who novelization that I'm aware of that has gilted pages, which was the 1970s paperback style in the US. So I had never heard at age 11 of Harlan Ellison before, so the first thing I read was not the novelization, but the 7-page Harlan Ellison introduction, which starts off with a dig at Star Wars and a dig at Star Trek. And as someone who was outgrowing Star Wars at that point, about 18 months after Return of the Jedi, this really hit my funny bone. My father was not a Doctor Who fan by any means, but the next thing he did after I read that was show me Demon with a Glass Hand.
Oh, very nice.
Later that year, the Twilight Zone revival shows up on CBS, and Harlan was the script editor, I think, for the first half of the first season, before leaving over creative differences.
Couldn't guess.
Later on, Harlan did several audio commentaries for the DVD release of that series, which are good episodes in that Twilight Zone revival. Harlan's commentary on those episodes is almost more entertaining than any of the underlying stories themselves. But he was assigned to adapt a Stephen King short story called Mother. His audio commentary for that is so much better than the actual episode, in which nothing happened.
Grandma is the episode.
That's the one, Grandma, yes.
Yes, he partially directed it as well.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. You had a very good timing in that regard, having the Twilight Zone come along right after you'd found out who he was, because Paladin of the Lost Hour, I think, is still one of his best stories. And though I like the written treatment better than the produced television, version. I think it sums up Harlan. It's about responsibility. And one of the things that Harlan felt a great responsibility for was imparting to people the things he was passionate about. Doctor Who being one of them. He and I talked about it constantly. He was watching all the way up through Stephen Moffat's run until he passed away. And he liked shining a light on people who he thought were doing good work. And Doctor Who was one of those things. He was, you know, in the Dangerous Visions books, as many people as were, you know, well known at the time for doing their SF work that are in the Dangerous Visions books, there are also a lot of people, it's their first stories, are being presented in those books.
Wow.
Because he was using the celebrities sort of, you know, to get the people to the book, and then he could show you these new people he'd found in writing workshops or he'd mentored, and it was sort of a symbiotic sort of thing. You know, you buy the book because you see it's going to have James Bush or whoever in it, Theodore Sturgeon, and then you get one of Harlan's finds.
Discovery, prototype.
Yes, exactly. And that's the one thing I look at it now, and so much of what I'm interested in came from Harlan. It's astonishing that Doctor Who brought me to Harlan, and then Harlan brought me to so much else of what I find interesting in the world. And from there, you know, spreading out from there. But he's had a profound influence on my tastes.
And it all begins with the novelization of Seeds of Doom.
Yes.
I should point out, Paladin of the Lost Hour stars Danny Kaye.
Yep, and last role.
Harlan was not... He said some critical things about Danny Kaye's performance on the audio commentary, but I'll point out the family connection. Danny Kaye grew up in the same neighborhood, went to the same public school as my grandmother, who bought me that book, and her older brother. So my great-uncle was friends with young Daniel Kaminsky as a child. My grandma used to do homework with Sylvia Fine, the future Mrs. Danny Kaye, who went to the same public school.
Mm.
So Brooklyn is a very, very, very small world in the 1910s and 20s.
The whole world is a small world, it seems to me, at this point. It's so many connections, you know. I used to work for a guy who was one of Harlan's protégés, you know, back in the 90s. And I had no idea they knew each other until I was in Harlan's dining room at some point, and we were just having a sort of wide-ranging conversation, and this name came up. I said, "How do you know so-and-so?" And he said, "Well, you know, he's one of the guys I mentored a bit."
Wow.
And I said, "Oh, great. You know, I worked for him for a year in college."
Hi, this is Jason from the future. As so often happens when you are conducting interviews in a crowded convention hotel, there are interruptions, you have to change locations, and that's exactly what happens here. I'm going to bridge to the next section of my interview with Jason Davis by saying this. I have a day job that requires me to think on my feet for a living and always be two or three questions ahead of the other fellow. I really, really dropped the ball during that interview with Jason Davis. He said that Harlan continued to watch Doctor Who right up through the Stephen Moffat era, Harlan passing away right around the time that Stephen passed the baton to Chris Chibnall, who was present at Gallifrey 1 in Los Angeles, by the way. I really should have followed up with about 7 or 8 or 9 different questions there. Harlan Ellison was still watching Doctor Who right up through the end of the Peter Capaldi era? What did he think? What were his impressions? What were his favorite stories? Who was his favorite new series doctor? Who was his favorite new series writer? Who was his favorite new series showrunner? What is it like to watch a Stephen Moffat-penned episode puzzle box with Harlan Ellison? These are all things that I should have asked and didn't. Jason will be back on the program, so I will certainly have a chance to get to that, hopefully. But boy, your humble interviewer really should have done some follow-up there and did not. Apologies. Let's get back to part two of my interview with Jason Davis, conducted in a different and slightly quieter hallway at the LAX Marriott, Gallifrey 1 weekend, February 2023, Los Angeles, California.
So I understand, looking at your website and bibliography, you have edited several compilations of Harlan Ellison's work. How did that come to pass?
It came via Babylon 5. I had been doing some work for the creator of Babylon 5, J. Michael Straczynski, and his publisher got into business with Harlan Ellison to produce some new books At the time, most of his back catalog was locked up elsewhere, but he wanted to do some new books. And I was put forward as the editor, and we got along incredibly well. I would almost say that he created the perfect editor by me finding him the way that I did, exploring his works to the extent that I did. And I'm a very obsessive person, so when I get interested in something, I try to go down every conceivable rabbit hole involved with that something. So by the time I was introduced to him in 2009, you know, I knew the full extent of his work. You know, in the past he'd had problems where people put science fiction on a book that was a book of essays about cultural criticism.
Right.
And he found it very frustrating because it's, you know, it's, at the end of the day, it's false advertising. He had a diverse array of interests. His publications were everything from mainstream fiction, the novel Spider Kiss, which is about the rise and fall of a rock star, to he did a lot of juvenile delinquency stories early on in his career, you know, and yet somehow he ended up getting labeled as science fiction writer Harlan Ellison, when really, you know, there are a handful of books that would fall into that category. Probably not even 20% of his output. You know, if anything, a sort of magic realism fantasy would be more appropriate for his more, you know, less grounded texts. But in the process of getting to know him, we worked very well together. And we produced several books. We did the Brain Movie series of his screenwriting, publishing some of the scripts from The Twilight Zone, in some cases with additional bonus materials. We did a book called Harlan 101, which was meant to be an introduction to Harlan. Had some of his best stories and had some of... it also doubled as kind of a instructional writing book. It had essays on writing and also alternative bits to some of the stories showing how he shaped them over time. We did another book of his film criticism, Harlan Ellison's Endlessly Watching. And we collected some of his previously uncollected... crime stories from the 50s.
Oh, wow.
When he was writing for the Pulps in a series called Honorable Whoredom at a Penny a Word.
What an amazing title. Wow.
Originally it was Whoredom at a Penny a Word, and he said Honorable Whoredom after he looked at the book, at the stories that I had assembled. So, yeah, that was, we did, how many books did we do before he passed away?
It was at least half a dozen that I saw looking at the bibliography on your site.
Definitely, we were, you know, approaching 20, and we had a bunch in preparation that he had worked on with me that we weren't able to get out printed before he passed away. But it, you know, the thing about him is that he has an omnivorous interest. You know, something would catch his eye and he would go after it, and I like to think that that was imparted to me in his writing. You know, I grew up reading all of these various publications, these essays on things, and I would seek out more information on the things that I was reading about. And I think Doctor Who has a similar effect on people, of making them interested in a variety of things. I mean, it's the original remit, the historical element of Doctor Who.
Yes, yes.
You know, so I think the two, Harlan Ellison and Doctor Who, work together on me. In a way that made me sort of devouring of all things that I can get my hands on, really. Anything that intellectually stimulates me, I go after it and I latch onto it. And Harlan was the same, and he liked to collect things, and I like to collect things, and I like to share the things I'm interested in with other people with this, maybe not quite as much enthusiasm as Harlan sometimes brought across, you know. But you know, he's had a profound effect on me in that regard. And I was happy to be able to do books for him, to preserve his works. We did a few reissues here and there. We finished Bloods Are Over, which was an expansion of A Boy and His Dog that he had been working on for many years. I was the editor of his last short story collection, Canon Cantankerous, from Subterranean Press.
Wow.
That was an interesting blend. That was the other thing that Harlan was interesting. He would take things from early in his career and put them side by side with things from more recent years. So you'd have an interesting collision of the youthful 1950s Harlan Ellison with the more thoughtful, reflective, you know, 2005 or 6 Harlan Ellison, and you have this interesting collection of stories that you could see where he came from and where he now was simultaneously.
Now, were all of these materials in a single unified archive, or was there a lot of digging, looking through yellowing papers and faded copies of old pulp magazines from the 50s?
It was a single unified archive with lots of yellowing papers from the 50s, of both things, yes. He had an extensive filing system, and he, for the most part, had all of the second sheets from his typewritten original manuscripts, up until he got the Xerox machine, yes. At which point, beyond there, he had them all. But, you know, and some of these pieces of paper were flaking apart, you know, in the file cabinets, because second sheets are not acid-free. They are,
yes.
They are, I mean, they're scrap paper, really, is what it came down to. And one of the things I did was I scanned it all for him. So it all exists in digital form.
That's amazing. Did you ever come across his original draft of that Pinnacle essay, and would you have any idea of how that came to be commissioned?
I know exactly how that came to be commissioned. It was written on November 1st, 1978.
It was right after I turned 5 years old. Wow.
He had recently been the guest of honor at IguanaCon in Phoenix, Arizona. And it was commissioned by Andy Ettinger. Now, I don't know what Mr. Ettinger's title was precisely at Pinnacle. But he and Mr. Ellison had a very long history, which takes us back to the mid-60s. I don't know why the connection was established, but Harlan's then agent asked him to write Andy Ettinger, who was then at a hardback house called Trident, because Harlan, after he came out of the army, was concentrating on stories of social realism. He had, during the army, he finished his first novel, which had been commissioned right before he was drafted, and he found that during his enlistment, rather, not enlistment, I guess he was drafted, so during his conscription, I should say, the time to write was at a premium. He could no longer churn out, you know, a story every night, sell it for a penny a word, because he just didn't have the time.
Right.
He was doing basic training, he's working the Army Information Office at Fort Knox, and he started focusing on in a way he hadn't previously. He would just write the stories that were really burning to be written. He wouldn't just write something because he needed to write something for that week's paycheck. He would write it because it's a story he had to tell right then, right there. And you have a range of stories that appeared in Rogue magazine in the late 50s, which was a competitor to Playboy. And Harlan, when he came out of the Army, was the editor, associate editor at Rogue, working for Bill Hamling, who had bought these first several stories, and he continued to buy Harlan stories for about a year while Harlan worked editing this magazine just after his release from the Army. And in this period, he also wrote Spider Kiss, the novel I mentioned earlier about the rock star, who was a very toxic personality, but he was incredibly talented, and it was about the dichotomy between this man who has this gorgeous voice that just, you know, it touches people, but he's this monster who just abuses everyone around him. And, you know, it may not have been based on Jerry Lee Lewis, you know, Harlan. Harlan would never, you know, he would sort of edge around it. I don't know if he ever actually said it outright. But Elvis's people wanted to option it at one point, but Colonel Parker wouldn't let him appear in it.
Oh,
for
wow.
Obvious reasons.
Yes.
You know, Colonel Parker, no fool. But so he was concentrating on these sort of stories. He was still doing things with an SF element to them, but he amassed this group of stories. The first batch of them was published in a book called Gentleman Junkie and Other Stories from the Hung Up Generation. And that book, after he had left Rogue and he was talking about moving to California to try screenwriting, that book was reviewed by Dorothy Parker, who wasn't used to reviewing paperbacks in her column,
wow,
in Esquire. And she gave it a very fine review, which you can see it. Harlan actually reprints it in the 1975 edition of that book from Pyramid. And that had a profound impact on him. That moment, that specific moment of reading that review in the offices at Fawcett Gold Medal in New York, he came back to a lot. He mentioned that moment and what it meant to him to have somebody of Dorothy Parker's quality say about his work what she said.
I want to point out, this may be the first conversation in history in which Dorothy Parker and Colonel Tom Parker are mentioned in the same breath.
Could be. And, you know, this was a profound thing, you know, and to have somebody say that about your work as you're about to roll the dice on moving to Los Angeles to work in television, completely, you know, it's completely alien to him. He has no connections. So to have that, you know, it's a vote of confidence. And he continued to write this sort of series of stories, these sort of very grounded stories. There's one called Neither Your Jenny Nor Mine, which is about abortion mills in Tijuana. There's one about a young African-American boy who wanders into a restaurant and is treated differently because of his color, and he doesn't perceive that that's what's happening, and a waiter takes him aside and you know, gives him the status quo of 1960. That story, which is, the title is currently escaping me at the moment, but it's one of the stories that's in Love Ain't Nothing But Sex Misspelled, which I still think is one of the best titles anyone has ever conceived for a collection of short stories. And that was to be the follow-up to Gentleman Junkie, this book, Love Ain't Nothing But Sex Misspelled. And he tried to sell this book, and people kept returning it to him because they didn't want to publish something this edgy. And for whatever reason, his then-agent Bob Mills put him in touch with Andy Ettinger. And for the next couple of years, they were batting this book back and forth between them. In the meantime, Harlan writes Repent, Harlequin, Said the TikTok Man. And he writes the episodes of The Outer Limits, Demon with a Glass Hand, which was an original, and then Soldier, which was based on an older short story.
And Soldier had a long afterlife, I believe, becoming something else.
legally speaking, yes. that's a different thing, but... But yeah, Soldier does have a bit of a history after that. But in the process of this, you know, Repent, Harlequin won the first Nebula Award after the founding of SFWA, and it won the Hugo Award. And then immediately after that, I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream also won the Hugo Award. And then City on the Edge of Forever, written for Star Trek. All of this is happening while Love Ain't Nothing But Sex Misspelled is while Ettinger's trying to get the pull to publish it at Trident. And it finally emerges in 1968. So by then, Harlan's won the Hugo for City on the Edge of Forever. His original screenplay, I should point out, is what won the Writers Guild Award. The produced episode won the Hugo. So slight dichotomy there. But so in this process, he sort of turned back to the sort of fantasy stuff. And so by the time Love Ain't Nothing But Sex Misspelled comes out, he's now writing Pretty Maggie Money Eyes. He's writing A Boy and His Dog. He's writing one of my personal favorites, which nobody ever mentions, Pennies Off a Dead Man's Eyes. And he's done the Dangerous Visions anthology, the first volume. So he's now going back away from the material that he had been so invested in the early 60s, just as it's finally published. And Ettinger goes on to move to Pocket Books and later to Pinnacle. And so by 1978, Harlan has been exposed to Doctor Who by Michael Moorcock. Probably, I don't know for a fact, but I'm guessing is around 1976. So I'm thinking probably, you know, toward the end of Sarah Jane's run, somewhere in there.
Watching perhaps Seeds of Doom, Brave
yes.
and Morbius.
Yeah, somewhere in that area, I believe, because he was in the UK in 76. And so he comes back, and Ettinger calls him up and says, can you write the introduction to these books that we've licensed from the BBC? And Harlan agrees. And thus you have the lure created to drag in his future editor, 20 years later. Almost.
And,
well, 10 years later.
At 11 years old, standing there on Ocean Avenue in Brooklyn reading this book in the sunlight, I had never heard the name Michael Moorcock before. I was too young. 30 years later, Moorcock himself writes a Doctor Who novel, The Coming of the Terrifiles.
Yes, tying it into his Jerry Cornelius books.
And that book is dedicated to Michael Chabon, who had written a Doctor Who-themed essay in his nonfiction anthology, Man and Amateurs. So you're talking about some of my favorite authors, and they all have this Doctor Who connection.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm sure we can loop in Neil Gaiman somehow or another. but given his actual episodes of Doctor Who.
Yes.
But and also episode of Babylon 5, on which Harlan was a creative consultant. Sorry, conceptual consultant. He was creative consultant on the Twilight Zone. By the time Babylon 5 came along, that title had been used in so many different ways that they went for a new title, and that was conceptual consultant.
And considering that Babylon 5 is full of amazing concepts, it's a very apt title. But of course, you have written much on Babylon 5 elsewhere.
Edited, yes.
I apologize.
I am writing, though. I do have a book on Babylon 5 in progress.
Yes, that's wonderful. And with all that, I have asked you today, I wanted to talk to you about a Doctor Who novelization, because you and I have both been reading them now since the 1980s. We've all read Harlan's Introduction to the Pinnacle, we've read the Pinnacles, we've read the Targets. Introduce us to the Target book that I imposed upon you to talk about for this conversation.
You gave me a choice, actually, and I probably chose a different one than what you would have imagined between the two that you gave me.
And I'm afraid you're going to have to wait a little bit longer to find out which book Jason Davis chose, and you're going to have to wait a little bit longer to hear that interview that will be coming up in a future episode after the break. My January 2023 interview with Philip Hinchcliffe.
Yes, I was sad to hear about Chris's death, and I thought he was much younger than me, actually, but he's about the same age as me, and it was a bit of a shock, really. Very sad.
So Chris came to Doctor Who, it was your third season, so season 14, and what's interesting is when you look at the writer list for most of that season, it's all veterans and returning writers. So you had the season premiere written by Louis Marks. You had two stories by Robert Holmes that year, both classics, Deadly Assassin and Talons of Wang Chiang. And then you also had a story by Bob Baker and Dave Martin, who had been with the production team since 1971 at that point, which is an eternity in television. But then Chris Boucher arrives, and he's a new writer to Doctor Who, and he gets a very rare honor that only happens a few times in Doctor Who's history. He gets to write back-to-back serials. So you have 2 months of television between Face of Evil and Robots of Death that is only written by Chris Boucher. Do you recall how he first came to the attention of the production office?
Oh, yes. He came to Bob Holmes's attention. And I remember Bob saying, I found this new writer. I think he might really work out very well. And so I think probably Bob was talking, kicking ideas around with Chris Boucher. And Chris was, didn't really have any track record. So he seemed to come out of the blue, really, although he had obviously been writing himself a bit, but he was an unknown quantity, really. Bob Holmes obviously encouraged him and brought him along, and I don't know in what order this happened, but we were thinking about a new a sort of assistant, I think. I can't remember the chronology of it, but anyway, that coincided with Chris bringing a story of the day that God went mad, a sort of computer that goes out of control to some extent, and he was very inventive, a new voice. He was the nearest, he wasn't like Bob Holmes in terms of his writing, but in some ways he was. He was inventive, economical, good with story, and sort of clever and kind of witty. And so there was a spark to his writing. And so Bob said, you know, well, and so we discussed, you know, the basic idea, which I was involved in to some degree, as I always was. But basically, you know, Bob went away and Chris, you know, came in with a very good first drafts. There were no major real problems, you know. And I was thrilled because you're right. We tended to rely on writers who knew, you know, the show and could sort of deal with it, or they were experienced. They understood how to tell a story within, you know, drama made in studios rather than on film. And so it was like a breath of fresh air, and it was terrific. I was so excited. And we thought, really, we've got a gem here. And then there was no doubt about, let's commission a new story. I had been wanting to do, since I took over the show, to do a robot story, but a different kind of robot story, you know, sort of post Asimov, you know, and you know, the prime directive, and the idea of a rogue robot. So basically, that's what I said to Bob. You know, I don't want to be, you know, stupid robot like we've done before. Something that's got real intelligence and all the rest of it. And Bob, I don't know, I think probably it was Bob who said, well, let's do it like a detective story. And so he was kicking all that around with Chris Broucher as well. And he was our chosen writer. So he and Chris worked out the plot. But I said, let's put it on a miner, you know, a mining ship, you know, something that could have come out of Dune, you know, just to make it different, you know. So that's how that happened. But, you know, Chris and Bob worked terribly well, and we got these, you know, pretty much classic, or one anyway. I think the robot story was pretty much turned out to be a classic, really, for all sorts of reasons. And the rather odd design thing which Michael Bryant brought to it, on the premise that, you know, they had a lot of downtime, so, you know, they didn't have to look like sweaty miners. They could just, you know, relax and let the machines and computers do the work. So it was a very happy sort of melange of creative input from various people. But you know, Chris was the foundation of it. I mean, he and I would, if we'd done another series, if Bob and I had done a fourth season, there's no doubt that Chris Boucher would have written at least two of those. I mean, he was a big find. It was very hard to find new writers who could master the problems of writing for Doctor Who, as might have been seen, you know, in years to come after me. I don't know. I don't know this, everybody, but it was a tough nut. You know, it was really tricky program. And here we had this fully formed writer with an imagination, bringing a fresh voice, seeing it differently, you know, and all the rest of it. So, yeah, I mean, I did contribute a bit to some of the scary moments in Robots of Death, and had a little bit of an influence on the first draft scripts. But basically, you know, again, you know, it was a very accomplished piece of writing, which was plotted by Bob and Chris together. And Chris went away and delivered very well with not much rewriting at all.
So when Chris passed away last month, December of 2022, there was this very large outpouring of grief all over the Doctor Who corners of social media that I inhabit. Number one, because he was the last surviving TV writer of the 1970s, which is definitely the end of an era. But not only that, it was the specific elements of his scripts, especially the two that he wrote for you. He did write one story in season 15 before moving on to a different show, which I want to talk about in a minute. But the elements of Face of Evil and Robots of Death, if you want to speak to this a little bit, number one, his plots, as you say, are wildly imaginative. You have the rogue computer playing God and creating this artificial society with two very different classes of human, the savages versus the technicians. Some of the dialogue in Face of Evil is still showing up in quotation books to this day. There's a very famous line from Face of Evil.
You know, the very powerful and the very stupid have one thing in common. They don't alter their views to fit the facts. They alter the facts to fit the views. Which can be uncomfortable if you happen to be one of the facts that needs altering.
Mm-hmm. And that's probably one of the lasting legacy quotes from Doctor Who in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. Still turns up over and over again because it's so applicable, yeah, even up to today's society.
And I've just remembered something about Face of Evil, which is that, like I said to Bob, you know, I'd like to do a robot story, but a modern one. Before we got Face of Evil, written in the early days of thinking about it, I said to Bob, I want to do a story where the Doctor has been to a planet and he doesn't remember that he's been there, but he's done something which is like the sort of, I don't know, the original mistake. The original sin, the original mistake, you know, something that has left a legacy that needs sort of sorting out. And funnily enough, now I look back over my sort of input into stories, that was a motif. I think a psychiatrist could have a field day with me on this, because on a number of stories, I've put that motif in about, you know, the Doctor's done something and then he has to rectify it. Maybe in one of these Big Finish stories, I've done that, you know, in the last few years. So I'm drawn to that for some reason. So that was a sort of building block of that story. But everything else was, you know, Chris Boucher. Yeah. If Bob had not carried on, or if I'd been asked to do another series and Bob hadn't stayed on, there's no doubt I would have snatched Chris Boucher up to be my script editor absolutely immediately. But I think that David Maloney was really fast out of the blocks, realized how good Chris was. And I think he snatched him and got him onto Blake 7. I think he was a sort of primary kind of writer on that, I think, as well as the editor. I'm not sure.
Yes, he ended up being the script editor on Blake 7, which came from an idea by Terry Nation. And there's a lot of Doctor Who crossover, because you have Michael E. Bryant, who directed Robots of Death, directed the first episode of Blake 7. And there's, yeah, a lot of crossover between actors and, in some cases, even monsters and props. So while Blake 7 is not a direct spinoff, it's very much the part of the larger Doctor Who universe, because there's so much similar talent involved.
Well, that's right, because they were there, you know, they were either in the BBC or they were part of the world of, you know, the production pool of talent that we were drawing upon, yeah, and which had been drawn on before I came on the scene as well.
Something else very enjoyable about Face of Evil is it gives Tom Baker a chance to do villain acting, because he is playing the voice of the computer that's gone mad, and you can hear Tom Baker having a lot of fun delivering evil dialogue.
Yeah, I forget the details of these plots, although they were all in my head at one point. But I was pleased with both of those stories, because they kind of, I was looking for a new feel in the program, and I think that other stories did it, but that those two, which were not sort of historical stories, really had a kind of a new sort of feel, where with the type of stories and the way they're told, and, you know, and that's kind of was what I was aiming, was to move the program in that way. And I think with our good historical stories, we did that as well. I mean, it seems to be, I know they did a lot of historical stories before us, but I think, again, we did something new with the way we handled them. So I think, you know, Chris was one side of the sort of sci-fi kind of movement that I managed, you know, to advance the program in that line. And he was, you know, he made a huge contribution with those two stories. Yeah.
Robots of Death. There's two things that I want to bring up about it. Number one, it continues the amazingly sharp dialogue that he was well known for. Robots of Death has one of the greatest insults probably delivered in the history of Doctor Who, when the Doctor turns to an antagonist and says,
"You know, you're a classic example of the inverse ratio between the size of the mouth and the size of the brain."
That's the kind of line I wish I could use in real life, but I've never quite mustered up the nerve.
Yeah, it's. I think I've heard that before. It's a sort of insult. I think you might even find a Cockney version of that, if you know what I mean.
And Robots also has had a pretty long afterlife, because Chris Boucher came back to Doctor Who and wrote a full-length novel that was a sequel to Robots of Death in the
mid-to-late
1990s.
I never knew that.
It's called Corpse Marker, which was a phrase from the original story, and it brings back the three surviving characters from the Sandminer, then shows them in Kaldor City, which was the city that they came from, with more robots turning evil and another conspiracy.
Yeah. By the way, just on the face of evil, I mean, I'm sure you know this, but, you know, Leela and her lot, they weren't savages. They were the survey team, weren't they? I mean, they were descendants. They'd regressed.
Yes, the computer, I think, had artificially regressed them to a savage state.
Oh, I didn't know that. I've forgotten that.
The Doctor mentions late in the story that it was an experiment in eugenics. That I would have been 11 or 12. I'd never heard that word before.
That's one of the few words I knew at the age of 12, because I think, as I've said before, that's the age I read Brave New World. You know, the Aldous Huxley book. And so I knew that word, eugenics.
Talking about Chris Boucher, the person, for a moment, one of the very first classic series DVDs that came out in America was Robots of Death.
And
I'll never forget this. The first three Doctor Who DVDs, and you contributed heavily to the range, but the very first three to come out came out on September 11th, 2001. Which is a terrible coincidence. So it was a while before I actually got to watch Robots of Death. But one of the things I remember vividly in the weeks after 9/11, when you're looking for any distraction to keep you going, you and Chris Boucher both recorded an audio commentary for Robots of Death, just the two of you sitting alone in the booth discussing the story. And it was fascinating for me, because it was the first time that I'd heard either of your voices, and you were discussing the story at length and in depth. And you had a very good line about the Russell Hunter character who had to wear a plastic Tupperware container as a hat. I think you said you have to be a very good actor to act in a hat like that. Do you have any memories of working with Chris Boucher on the DVD doing the audio commentary that day?
Vaguely, now you've reminded me, I did a lot of those commentaries around about that time, I think. Nothing, because you didn't prepare, really. You just went in there and then you watched the program. And for people like me, it was a long time before, but at least he had the script in his head, you know. So you just react to what, you know, comes into your head at the time of what you recall. But that, you know, quite a few years have passed now. I can't recall. I can vaguely remember doing it, but I don't remember any details, I'm afraid.
And he was very busy in television for a long time after Doctor Who, with Blake 7 and then with Juliet Bravo, among other programs. And then, of course, later on, writing books for the series. And Big Finish has also done a spin-off series, Descended from the Robots of Death. Did you ever have any professional contact with Chris again after you both left Doctor Who?
No, I didn't really. I think I bumped into him once or twice, but I think, I mean, he was a very sort of modest and rather, I don't know whether he was shy, but he was very much a sort of retiring sort of person. You know, I mean, he was very sort of bold and positive in his writing, but I don't think he, well, I don't think he sort of socialized a lot. I didn't, you know, I didn't get to know him well, really, at all. He wasn't around, or I wasn't around probably long enough to get him, you know, get to know him very well. There was no downtime when I was producing the show to sort of really get to know anybody outside the show, really. I was always encouraging to him whenever I bumped into him. It's, oh, you know, you can do this, you can do that. You know, I was really impressed by him, and I tried to be encouraging and saying, you know, what about doing that, the other. I guess he had an agent, and he did a fair bit of work, and I suppose he became known to other BBC producers, and so he got work, you know, on these other BBC series. I think he was capable of coming up with a lot more than he probably did in his career. I was under the impression that he's sort of not retired, but he just kind of disappeared a bit. And I thought that was a huge shame. He was such a talented writer, with I think who had a great future ahead. But I mean, he wasn't a pushy type person. And I can't remember who his agent was, but he needed a pushy agent, really.
Yes.
Obviously he achieved a lot in his career. And funnily enough, he was sort of lured into something at the end, by Big Finish, like I was, you know, suddenly brought back to this program, you know, that we both did all those years ago, you know.
And he ended up writing a total of 4 novels for Doctor Who. That was a line that unfortunately came to an end when the new series got revived in 2005. So his last book came out in 2004, which I just read for the first time during the pandemic. It's got, as you'd expect from him, a lot of memorable dialogue and set pieces and some social commentary and satire. So certainly a tremendous talent. It's a shame that we've lost him at what still seems a very young age. He was still in his 70s.
Yeah, it is, and as I say, I just thought he had he arrived on the scene, and I thought, wow, you know, he's really going to go places. But I don't know, you know, people need encouragement, but they also challenges as well, and it's so much of this business is luck, really, or chance. Not luck, but chance. You know, you need to be thrown the challenges, and then rise to them, or you don't. And but you have to be in the mix. It doesn't mean you have to be going to parties and meeting people or anything like that. But you have to sort of be a presence, you know, with your work on the scene and being talked about. And I suppose. I may be totally wrong about this, but I kind of felt maybe Chris just that wasn't that side of it all wasn't happening for him, you know. But I don't know, because I don't know him at all, you know, very well.
He did, I believe he did not do a lot of convention appearances. And as you say, he does have the reputation for being on the shy side. But between his Doctor Who work and Blake 7, he has certainly given fandom a lot to enjoy on television, and I know for a fact that his stories are still being watched and still being discussed heavily by Doctor Who fandom today. So on that side of things, it's wonderful that your era discovered him and that he joined Doctor Who, and in a way never really left the show after that.
Yeah, it was great to work with him, and he made a big contribution to my, I mean, I only did 3 seasons on this program, and he was a big part of that season. And I was very grateful for discovering his talent. Well, for Bob discovering him, and the way Chris you know, rose to the challenge very quickly. I mean, he turned those scripts around really quickly, and it was marvelous. He would have been one of the, as I said, he would have been one of the planks. You know, he would have given me confidence that I've got a writer that, you know, can give me a third of another season. It would have been. That's how highly I rated him. He would have been absolutely a major plank in our fourth season. Yeah, no question about it.
Graham Williams and Anthony Reed, who followed you, did some very good work in the end, but I do weep to think that we could have had a full season of Chris Boucher as script editor, and that's a huge loss, not having had that opportunity.
Yes, it would. It has been. Yeah, it has been. Yeah. Right. Still, I had Bob Holmes at the time, and he was the king for me.
Oh yes, very few did it as well as Bob Holmes, certainly. Philip, I want to thank you so much for your time and your generosity in speaking with me today and sharing your memories about Chris Boucher and your time on Doctor Who. Thank you so much again.
Okay, my pleasure.
Next week on Doctor Who Literature, we arrive in the John Nathan Turner era. We arrive in the calendar year 1982. It is only the second Target novelization to feature the new JNT era neon tube logo. It is the first novelization of a season 18 story. It is the first novelization with Adric. It is the novelization of the story that was originally supposed to air in the slot that later became Horror of Fang Rock, which, as long-time listeners of this program will know, is one of my absolute all-time favorite Doctor Who stories, and one of my all-time favorite Doctor Who novelizations as well. I refer you back to episode 40 for that conversation and that review. But the story that's coming up next week is also one of my absolute favorites, for my money, one of the scariest and best-made episodes of the classic series. And it is Doctor Who and the State of Decay. Join me and a returning guest to talk about this book, that season, the JNT era, and many, many other things. Before we go, excerpts, the portions that are appropriate for a family audience. Anyway, of my casual chat with Dave Barsky and Bill Evenson in Bill's hotel room at the Marriott LAX during the Gallifrey One convention last week. I am sitting here with two of the preeminent gentlemen of Doctor Who literature. They have both been on multiple episodes in the past, and they will both be on multiple episodes in the future. It is Mr. David Barsky and Mr. Bill Evenson, although I'm not quite sure which is which at this point.
I've never known.
And you've had frighteningly a little to drink for not knowing who we are.
After,
I don't know who I am.
After 48 hours of running around this con, talking to people and meeting new people, I kind of have the vapors, as they used to
there
say.
There you go, the vapors.
Back in the day.
Yeah.
We're missing a very
it's
good...
It's going around.
Missing a very good Bonnie Langford interview downstairs with Gary Russell. People are saving me a seat. I'll get back to it. Can't have a con without having you two guys in the room and talking to you for a quick... shot on my podcast. How are things going? What number con is this for you? What number galley?
I haven't counted, really, because I skip a few every now and then. So I'm going to say it could be 8 for me. No, a very small number. I'm in single digits, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah.
I know it's over 10. I came 17 years ago.
Wow.
So, I don't think I came for maybe 3 years after that. But I've been, it's over 10, maybe 12. You?
My first was 2008 when I lived out here. This is before I knew Barsky personally.
Wow.
I went to 08. I was standing next to Stephen Moffat in the lobby, and somebody says, "You want to talk to Moffat?" I'm like, "No." Then, of course, he becomes showrunner 5 minutes later. Always regret saying no to that. Then I didn't come back again until 2015, and I've been here almost every year since then, so this is number 9 for me.
Well, when Moffat was here last, I was friends, well, I still am, we just talked to him down in the dealer's room, with Matthew Jacobs, who wrote the TV movie. And I was talking to him at the bar down at the lobby, and Moffat was at the other end of the bar. And Matthew just goes, "Hey, Stephen Moffat's sitting over there." I was like, "Oh, have you met him?" I assumed he had, because two writers of Doctor Who, whatever. He goes, "No, I've never met him." I said, "Well, why don't you go meet him?" "Oh, I don't know him." I said, "Let's just go and meet him." So we walk over, and, you know, hey, Stephen was just talking. He's like any other dorky fan. It was, and Matthew had is also an actor. And he had just played a few years back Igor in a movie you might have heard of, Frankenstein.
I've heard of it.
Yeah, not the Boris Karloff one.
Oh, like, not that one.
Frankenstein, isn't that a breakfast cereal?
That's yeah. Gotta be.
And you know, he, because at the time Moffat was doing the Dracula adaptation.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, the two classic mega literature, you know. Yeah. So he just, so Matthew just offered. I played Igor in Frankenstein. And then, and Moffat just says, "Well, that's the worst book ever written." And I said, "What?" I got in his face, basically. I was like, you're completely wrong. First of all, you've probably never read the third Dune book. And
I was going to say he's never read Dracula.
Yeah, no, well, I went down there. I did that too. I agree, Dracula's not as well written.
Nowhere near.
And Frankenstein's not even close to the worst. It's a very good read.
It's a very
good
book.
For the time it was written.
17-year-old girl. Yeah, wrote an amazing book. Yeah. I stand by that.
I think the prose in that is better than War of the Worlds, for instance. H.G. Wells stuff.
Yeah, right.
Archaic.
Yeah.
In my opinion,
Dracula gets off to a good start. I love the Harkonnen material in Dracula.
Yeah, Dracula's. I shouldn't say it's shit.
When Van Helsing shows up, Van Helsing doesn't stop talking. Keeps talking about God every three lines. I don't care. It's Van Helsing should have been like Doctor Who. Instead, Van Helsing is a bore.
Yeah. It's a book. At that point, had it already been a play or no? No.
The book came first.
Book came first. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, it was funny. And I was having dinner in the restaurant the next night, and Moffat was in the next table. There was a divider, so, you know, fisticuffs didn't happen. But, you know, I saw him, and I called the waiter over. I said, "Hey, I want to pick up this guy's check." And he gave it to me, and I wrote on the check, I wrote, "I don't care how bad your taste is in literature, you're still a cool guy. You're welcome." And he had no idea. He probably remembers who it was, but he didn't see me.
Probably has no idea, but who cares?
Yeah.
That's just ignorant. I love that book.
It's a great book.
Now, I spoke to Matthew and Vanessa at LI Who 3 months ago. I played a brief part of the interview on this show. We did the main interview on Trap One. They are great people.
Wonderful.
Watched the movie last night. And as I'm watching the credits to the movie, there's the acknowledgments, David Barsky.
I was surprised.
Yeah, what the hell?
I was very surprised when I saw that. Actually, at LI Who, Jeff Elson saw it, and he texted me the screen grab of my name, and my wife's name is on it, too.
Yes.
And I haven't spoke to them in a bit, and I saw them at the dealer's room, and I said, you know, "Thank you, by the way, for the credit." She goes, "Oh, don't be silly." And I'm like, "I didn't do diddly squat." It's like you give me a producer credit in your podcast. I don't do shit.
Look, you have gotten me connections to Jason Davis and Philip Hinchcliffe. There's going to be an episode coming up, which is half Jason Davis, half Philip Hinchcliffe. You're getting producer credit on that.
100%. Well,
why am I not on that episode?
I invited you to sit on an interview with Jason.
No, Jason deserves his own time, obviously.
Last year, a year ago, February 2022, the three of us are having lunch at Hangar 18 downstairs.
That's right. Oh, that's where it all began.
My podcast was in the embryonic stage, 10 episodes in the can. I barely had any guests. You guys sat me down. You started talking. You started pitching guests. Somebody ran over, dragged over John Peel, got him to agree to be on the show. So
remember that at all.
You guys have been heavily involved in the conception of this show.
Well, you know, it's a great show.
Which is why I keep bringing you back, even though Bill and 20 Questions are not exactly...
Yeah.
I was the reigning champion the first time. I don't know what I did the second.
Because you were the only second person ever did it.
Probably.
Yeah.
I was a guinea pig for the cliffhanger one.
And you were also a guinea pig for the limericks
challenge. Oh, I was?
Yeah, you were the first limerick.
Oh, I didn't realize that for some reason. I did okay in that one.
And after you didn't like my rhymes, you were the last one to play the limerick.
Oh, that's right. Okay, yeah. Okay, yeah. Well, I didn't say I didn't like them. Let's just say
you did it, and now it's canceled. We're not doing it anymore.
He's the glass of fashion and the mold of form. Never need to do it again.
Well, that's probably best for all of us.
No,
surprisingly few complaints.
You guys have been very good friends to the show, both. You always happy to have you on whenever you want to be. Although we're going to work on your 20 question skills.
Yeah, but... no, we'll find another game for me.
That's my favorite game. It's just so much fun.
I do like it.
Thinking about these great stories and all that kind of stuff.
I do like it. I can do better next time. I'll kick ass. I'm so embarrassed about my performance on.
As well, you should.
I should be. So I think I got it in 26.
I did some creative editing to make it seem as if
you really did.
You seriously?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
That's brutal.
Pause the tape, put a foot on the scale. When I step on your foot three times and say hello, Mr. Thompson, you smile and nod.
You literally just ruined what little magic to the whole thing
was.
Yeah,
the magic is all.
My God.
This is all getting cut out.
No, it's not.
This might be. Might be getting cut.
Probably
out.
Should.
I do some light editing for this show, but this conversation is golden. Okay. So, Bill, apart from the open bar, what is the highlight of the con for you?
He sees nothing else.
We have booze in the room, so I don't have to go down to the bar. And so the highlight is sitting on the balcony. You've got a balcony room. We saw the Verity in defense of panel. Yeah. I really enjoyed that. Yeah, that was a good
fun.
Time. I love the everybody in Verity.
Well, we probably should talk about another podcast on your podcast.
Oh, I'm.
Warren Fry is going to make a very brief cameo later on in this show.
Okay,
who's that again?
I don't know who that is either. Yeah, that's.
Well, I got to tell you, no.
That sounds made up.
We talked about Radio Free Scar on your show before, and that's because they got me back into fandom because Galley 22 I was thinking of going to. And I was like looking at the guest list, and I didn't want to make time for it. But then there was a little tile on the website for this thing called Radio Free Scar. It's a podcast. I'm like, I didn't even know what a podcast was at that time. But, you know, as I said, I probably already said it on the show, though. The title of the episode was Grimwade Syndrome. And I'm like, oh, these guys know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to listen. And, you know, their enthusiasm. And I just like nerds talking about things I love and still learning from it. Like, you know, I have some good knowledge, I guess, about certain things. But if I still learn from a guy's just shooting the shit like we are doing right now.
Absolutely.
I love that. That's my favorite kind of podcast. I don't like the structured podcast, things like that.
They are the Manchester United of podcasts. I am the Seattle Mariners of podcasts. I have zero rings. I never will have a ring. I'm a small market podcast.
Well, I'm a Hammers guy myself, so I don't know about Man U, but whatever.
Insert naming rating. I'm not going to say New York Yankees around you because you're sitting there in your Boston jersey.
I believe you just did.
Whoops!
I heard it.
Whoopsie!
Something else I'll have to edit out of this conversation.
Yeah, absolutely.
What's
good luck
next?
editing out of real life. That's what you need to do.
No, look, we can still be friends. Well, you're a Mets fan anyway.
I don't think you guys are going to be friends.
No. He's a Mets fan, although, the Mets did that 86 series. Why did you have to bring the Mets up?
I gotta be honest. I think when it comes to baseball, I think there's something sort of romantic about being a Mets fan. Like, it's like a cool thing to be. Yeah. And Jason's a trend. You know, he's trendy. He doesn't really care.
All right. Fine.
Wait, which Jason is trendy now? Jason Davis is trendy.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm a Twins fan. I don't know nothing. We got a couple of World Series.
You have two rings.
That's fucking great.
Tom Kelly, 1987.
Tom Kelly,
a guy who can win the World Series with Greg Gagne and Steve Lombardozzi up the middle. That is a special kind of manager.
To take those... You know more about the Twins than I do. That's awesome.
Well, Frank Viola's all an island boy.
Okay. Oh, I didn't know that. That's awesome. Uh-huh. Yeah. Viola,
Bert Blyleven is not.
Blyleven is the one.
He's in the Hall of Fame for reasons I don't understand.
Yeah, but he was, because he was.
He paid the most money that year.
He's a superstar. You're a maniac. You don't recognize it. He's a superstar.
Had a wicked curveball. Who was the number three starter? I apologize to my UK fans. Three Americans in the room. Maybe I'll edit this out. Who was the number three starter on the 1987 Twins? Viola, Blyleven, and.
Oh my God.
Oh God. I bet I know is what sucks. And I'm not a baseball guy,
yeah,
but I bet
be
I
happy
know
you
this.
Don't know.
I don't
he
know.
Knows
I
the
don't
answer.
Know.
Les Straker.
Oh yeah. Wow.
I'm gonna now venture to say if you take every baseball podcast ever recorded, I bet Les Straker has been mentioned exactly zero times.
But yet on a Doctor Who podcast.
Yes, it comes up on every Doctor Who podcast.
Les, if you're listening, welcome to the team, buddy. You've got a standing invite to come on my show and talk about Doctor Who.
Oh my God. 87 Twins. We could talk about it all
in
day.
In fact,
we could do 4 hours on it.
Didn't,
and I don't care.
Didn't Radio Free Scar have an episode titled Striker Strikeouts? I don't know.
Grimwade syndrome was a pretty deep cut.
Yeah, no, but that's a good one. I knew what that was, you know, and I was like, holy crap, these guys know what they're talking about.
Some great Doctor Who costumes this year. We have a Drashig. We have
the Carnival of Monsters.
And on that note, this has been a very fun recording. Thank you guys so much. We'll see you next year.
Thank you.
Do you know what's wrong with Pooh? Ivanov?
Yes. Robophobia.
That's right. The lawyer'd call it Grimwade syndrome.
Thank you for joining me on another episode of the Doctor Who Literature Podcast. This episode was produced, hosted, and edited by yours truly, was executive produced by David Barsky, and was, well, contributed to, somehow, by Bill Evenson. Special thanks to my special guests, Philip Hinchcliffe and Jason Davis. This podcast can be found on most of your podcast apps of choice. You can find all past episodes at anchor.fm/Doctor Who Lit. It really helps if you rate 5 stars and subscribe. You can find Jason Davis at thejasondavis.com. You can find me on Twitter at Doctor Who Novels. That's Dr. Who Novels. You can find my old tweets about the entire series under the hashtag Doctor Who Pilgrimage. That's Dr. Who Pilgrimage. My current Twilight Zone watch through under hashtag TZ Pilgrimage. And on email at Doctor Who Literature, that's drwholiterature@gmail.com. Please drop me a line with your comments, questions, and suggestions. Thank you for listening, and whatever you do, keep turning the pages.
Doctor Who Podcast Network.